The Space Station Communications paper is jointly authored by Mr. Andrew Edelman and Mr. Robert Hockenberger from IBM in Huntsville. Mr. Hockenberger, who will actually present the paper today, he was born in Utica, New York, and educated at the University of Florida and the University of Cincinnati, where he received the bachelor's in electrical engineering with honors and master's degrees, respectively. He has worked on the design and development of advanced communication systems with Avco from 1958 to 62 and with IBM since that time. He is an advisory engineer at IBM Huntsville, Alabama nowadays. Mr. Hockenberger.
IBM has been involved with a Phase B study, that is a conceptual design of the information management system for the space station program. During this study, we have examined different communication system concepts. This morning, I will discuss the communication aspects of the space station program. First, I will want to review the general concepts of the space station program and the proposed experiments to be conducted during this 10-year program life. The amount of experimental data gathered during this program is so great that it requires new concepts for communication systems and data reduction facilities. I will outline the requirements imposed on these by the experiment program. Then I'll discuss six alternate options that we investigated in order to return the data to Earth. Only four of these options had been completed at the time of final edition of the paper. Since then, we've added two options. We'll discuss some of the more important aspects of these systems, and we'll go into the preferred concept in detail. No paper would be complete without a discussion of the ground system in conjunction with the space communications. Therefore, I'll briefly discuss our recommended system of a centralized ground support system for the space station program. The space station program has four major functions: to evolve manned scientific observation capabilities in space, to prepare and operate complex scientific instrumentation, to further study man's capability to operate safely and efficiently in space for extended periods, and to perfect spaceflight technologies. The space station concept at the present time consists of five cylindrical segments 33 feet in diameter, the five segments approximately 100 feet long total. One segment houses the command control center, another segment the experiment control center. That way, in an emergency, either center could assume the duties of the other. The other segments contain crew quarters, galley, sick bay, docking ports, in addition to the attached experiment modules and space laboratories. The space station, in order to handle all of the data being generated, has a data bus designed into it. I don't intend to go into details on the data bus at this time, only to say that it's multiple channel multiplexed, both time division multiplexed and frequency division multiplexed. The experiment program represents the largest source of data. Housekeeping and checkout data is less than 1% of the total data load. The historical growth of data can be seen from this slide. This shaded area represents the amount of data reduction and data processing necessary on board the station in order to keep the data to the ground in manageable proportions. As it is, and to give you an idea of the amount of data, 10 to the 12 bits of data per day is enough information to fill over 100,000 books a day. If you were to store that information on punch cards, it would take about 14,000 railroad cars stretching from here to San Diego to store a year's worth of data. This slide is a representation of the timeline analysis that we performed in order to come up with typical data rates. As you'll notice, because of the typical set of experiments, we reach peak data rates of about 22 megabits per second, with an average something less than 11 megabits per second. You'll notice that there are two main driving functions. That is the solar astronomy and the Earth surveys experiments. They force most of this peak data. They can be on simultaneously. As you add experiments, which will happen, the data rates will increase. Consequently, the problem is going to become more severe. And these rates impose severe requirements on the communication systems. The experiment analysis leads us to these requirements for the communication capabilities, internal and external. You can see that the internal communication system, at this point in time, must service 23 TV sources. We have a slight error in terms of the digital data rates. You see 10 to the 12th bits per day, that's representative of 10 megabits per second, not per day. Likewise, the 22 megabits per second peak. 22 voice channels internal. That represents to an external, that is the space-to-ground channels. We must have two channels for TV downlink, one for uplink. One, and this should be 1 megabit per second also. That should be a continuous data channel to the ground. In order to handle this amount of data, we need a continuous data channel to the ground. Five full duplex voice channels. To return this data to Earth, we've identified at the present time six alternate communication systems, running from a very austere program where we record all data on board the space station and bring it back via a space shuttle, all the way up to three DRS, an Inosat 4, and two ground sites, where the Inosat 4 would be providing a TV and voice links between a ground station in Australia and a centrally located ground station in the United States. The austere option, the record and bring back, has contact with the ground, except in an emergency when shortwave radio may be used, only when in direct line of sight with a designated ground station, a definite handicap. The 3DRSS configuration has 100% contact coverage in time with the space station. The Inosat 4 link is used for real-time data transfer between Australia and the United States. The other four options, capabilities, complexities, and cost, lie somewhere between the other two. This is a pictorial diagram of the 3D data relay satellites, the two ground stations, and an Inosat link between the ground station in Australia and the ground station in the United States. Now, if you eliminate one data relay satellite, and you move this data relay satellite down to somewhere around 170 to 175 degrees away from this one, you can get approximately 98% coverage of the space station, and you can eliminate the Australia ground station and hence the Inosat 4 link to the United States. The question arises, why not use Inosat 4 rather than distinctly designated data relay satellites for the space station program? This slide illustrates the capabilities with respect to one another. The Inosat 4, in its present configuration, because of the antenna and power restrictions of the space station, has no capability for TV. If you modify that slightly with a 3.3-foot diameter parabolic tracking antenna system, you still cannot get commercial quality TV, but only one Apollo quality TV channel. For comparison, this is the capability designated at the present moment for the data relay satellite system. The space station has a 15-foot diameter parabolic antenna and a 30-watt transmitter power assumed on the space station. Recording all the data on board and subsequently shipping it to the ground via a space shuttle has some odd characteristics. First of all, the shuttle system is scheduled for, at the present time, I believe, 90-day flights. This automatically means that unless you're transmitting to a ground station as you pass over it, there is an inherent 90-day delay from the time that you record the data to the time that you start to process it. Not only that, but the amount of data being generated, if you put it on a high-density magnetic tape recorder and didn't play any of it back as you passed over a ground station, would entail 19,000 pounds of magnetic tape every 180 days. Now, if you assumed that you could play back video an average of 208 minutes a day, and I'll get into why the 208 minutes. If you could play back video 208 minutes per day, then you would reduce this loading requirement to 13,806 pounds per 180 days. The 208 minutes is a requirement for real-time TV transmission so that the principal investigator located on the ground can interface with the experiment being conducted by the astronaut on board the space station. He needs this real-time data to assess the quality of data he's receiving and to somewhat control the experiment. The preferred concept that we recommend involves two DRS, two data relay satellites, one ground station, and the interface is shown in this diagram. I'd like to go through these interfaces with you. You notice we have a link between the space station and the data relay satellite. We've chosen a frequency somewhere between 13 to 15 gigahertz. The reason for this is because of the antenna and transmitter power restrictions. While the link between the shuttle, or intermediate logistic vehicles, and the space station to EVA, is kept in the VHF range. That's to facilitate omnidirectional antenna systems so that we don't have any attitude constraints imposed by the communications. The MSFN tracking network is already at 2.2 gigahertz. We propose 13 to 15 gigahertz as a frequency for the link between the free-flying modules and the space station. Now, the space station is to control these free-flying modules, their attitude, and receive data back from them. The reason for using the 13 to 15 gigahertz frequency range is that the space station has, at the present time, four 15-foot parabolic antenna, high-gain directional antennas, in use for tracking the data relay satellites. Now, only two or three of those will be in use at any time, giving us a free antenna system already designed and already there. Consequently, the 13 to 15 gigahertz link. Real-time ground operations are planned in the space station program, especially for the principal investigator to be able to interface with the space station while experiments are being conducted. The data will be generated down through the DRS to the ground station site. The data at that point will be transmitted along a standard AT&T line into the data link interface. This is the ground station complex. You notice that the data is processed here. The data center provides an interface to the remote terminals, that is, the users, away from the central site. The ground station will operate in a conventional data processing mode because the mission is not at stake. If something goes wrong on the ground station, some experiment data might be lost. We visualize no need for specialized hardware or redundancy. Consequently, it will be a standard processing mode. The next two slides summarize the various communication options and their capabilities. The record-only option is the least costly. Consequently, we've normalized all of the cost factors to this approach. It has minimum cost, but unfortunately, least capability. The three DRSS, two ground stations, and Intelsat 4, containing a TV and voice link, have the greatest capability. Unfortunately, it also has the greatest cost. These cost numbers will differ slightly from what's in the paper. At the time that we generated these numbers, cost factors changed slightly. The preferred concept, that is of two DRS, one ground station, runs about a little less than six times the cost of the record and bring back. It's very flexible, although it only has 98% coverage, whereas the three DRSS has 100%. It meets the requirements, and in our minds, is most cost effective. Now, I'd like to emphasize to you that in doing a study of this sort, there are a lot of questions about what's adequate cost for one factor or another. One of the primary functions that this cost analysis depends upon is the price that you have to pay to return so many pounds of data back via the shuttle. For this study, we used approximately $100 per pound for cost of shuttle operation. Now, you'll notice that it gives us this kind of separation between the cost of record and playback over continental United States stations, the preferred concept of the wideband data relay satellite system, the record and bring back option, as you approach $1,000 per pound cost, you'll notice that the record and bring back lose the cost advantage and become almost as expensive as a complicated communications network. Assuming $100 per pound shuttle costs, the relative normalized yearly costs look like shown in the chart. These costs are factored in assuming a 1977 launch date. You can see that the preferred concept is more expensive, but on the other hand has a great deal more capability. Only four options are shown here. The other two fall in between. One thing I would like to emphasize that we did discover in this study, regardless of what cost you assume for the shuttle, one thing becomes immediately apparent. That is, if you want near real-time transfer of TV data from any station other than a continental United States station, you're going to pay and pay very highly for TV links from other continents to the United States. It becomes prohibitive. Consequently, we abandoned that approach very early in the study. In conclusion, the results of these studies show that while the amount of data generated is enormous, it certainly is not unmanageable. The preferred communication network consists of two data relay satellites, one ground station, and gives us 98% coverage. Large orders of magnitude of data reduction is possible by processing data on board the space station. If we store only pertinent information, then we can obtain low-cost archiving and data distribution.
We now have a question as to the power requirements of the system and the power sources envisioned.
At the present time, we envision a 30 to 50 watt transmitter on board the space station. The power requirement on the data relay satellite is approximately the same. For the link from the data relay satellite to the ground, there's not much problem in the power requirements because of the large antenna systems on the ground. The 30 to 50 watts we don't see as a great restriction. That's one of the reasons why the 13 to 15 gigahertz range was selected rather than going up higher and requiring more advanced technology.
Another question. What sort of communication link bandwidths will be required?
Nominal TV requirement, about 20 megahertz. 40 megahertz probably, 40 megahertz RF. Information bandwidths, about 4 megahertz.
What is the expected life of the space station in orbit, and are they set up for stationary orbits? The speaker's answer was, the expected lifetime of the space station is 10 years, and the orbit is a 250-mile altitude orbit, which produces about 15 orbits per day. This concluded the question period.
The next paper is by Mr. Bruce Bachauer of GE on the Earth Resources Technology Satellite System. Mr. Bachauer obtained a BS in Electrical Engineering from Lehigh University and MS in Engineering Management from Drexel Institute of Technology. He has been with GE since 1955 and has been associated with the space program for the last 10 years. From 62 to 65, Mr. Bachauer was manager of system evaluation engineering for the OAO program. And for 3 years after that, he was manager of design, integration, and test for the Voyager project. Since 1968, Bruce has served as systems manager for the Earth Resources Technology Satellite Program, responsible for system definition, starting with the proposal phase through the phase B and C studies, and then the present phase D study that's in progress now. Mr. Bachauer.
The Earth Resource Technology Satellite, or ERTS as we usually refer to it, has two basic mission goals. The first and the prime goal is the acquisition of multispectral data of the surface of the Earth. The second goal
is the collection of data from remotely distributed platforms over the surface of the Earth. Now, because of the importance of this primary goal, two types of multispectral imaging sensors have been selected for use. One is a camera system using return beam vidicons, which operates in three spectral bands, and one is a line scanning device known as a multispectral scanning instrument, operating in four spectral bands for ERTS-A. For ERTS-B, there'll be a fifth band added to that sensor. These sensors, as well as a data relay system, is mounted in a spacecraft, which is an adaptation of an existing space system. And the space system is supported by a ground system for the operation of the spacecraft, the accumulation of data, and the processing of this data in a form that's usable for the ultimate users of this information. Now, this first slide shows the overall ERTS system. The spacecraft operates in approximately 500 nautical miles sun-synchronous orbit. It views the Earth at the sub-satellite point in a swath about 100 nautical miles wide. The payload wideband data is transferred from the spacecraft to various receiving sites. For ERTS, there are three prime sites, one at Corpus Christi, Texas, one at Alaska, and one, the NASA Test and Training Facility at Goddard at Greenbelt, Maryland. These stations are part of two different NASA networks, the Manned Spaceflight Network and the STATAN Network. Now, the wideband data is transmitted, as I say, from the spacecraft to the ground stations and recorded at that point, and then is mailed to the data processing facility. The telemetry and the tracking data from these remote sites to the operations control center is transferred essentially at real time through the NASA communications facilities. The orbit information is broken off, goes through orbit computations for determining the parameters of the orbit and the corrections required. Operations Control Center is the focal point for operations here. The mission planning is done, the scheduling of the system. The commands are generated for operation of the spacecraft. The spacecraft housekeeping telemetry is monitored, and the status and health of the sensors are kept track of. The NASA data processing facility, the basic function here is to convert the video imagery to film and go through the photo processing and distribution to the users. Together, the Operations Control Center and the NASA Data Processing Facility comprise what we call the Ground Data Handling System. Both of these systems are co-located in an existing building, or will be in an existing building at Goddard. Now, in the next three slides, I'm going to briefly review the spacecraft system, then the Operations Control Center, and then the NASA Data Processing Facility. This is the overall spacecraft configuration. It is governed or patterned largely after the Nimbus spacecraft design. Earth is looking down. This is the multispectral scanner. It has an aperture here, behind which is a rocking mirror, which causes the device to scan perpendicular to the spacecraft motion. The spacecraft motion provides the line-to-line scanning. It scans a swath on the ground approximately 100 nautical miles wide. Behind the scanner are three individual cameras, each operating in a specific spectral band. These are part of the return beam vidicon camera system. They image a 100 by 100 nautical mile area on the ground. They are shuttered approximately every 25 seconds so that as we progress in orbit, we have a 100 by 100 nautical mile area overlapped by about 10% with the next image, another 100 by 100 nautical mile area, and so forth. And again, we cover a swath about 100 nautical miles wide. The wideband tape recorders, there are two which are part of the payload, are located in the central part of the torus section here. They're not visible. Either around the periphery of this torus section are modular areas where payload electronics and spacecraft electronics are housed. Just above the torus section here, near the center of gravity of the spacecraft, is the orbit adjust system. It's a hydrazine monopropellant system for providing orbit adjust capability. On the top is the attitude control system. using horizon scanners and a gyro compass to provide three-axis attitude control. Attached to it are the solar arrays, which are free to move about one axis and track the sun as we move in orbit. Now, in this particular program, we are making maximum use of applying existing space-proven hardware. The spacecraft design is primarily designed around the Nimbus 4 spacecraft and its subsystems. Briefly, these subsystems and their similarity to the Nimbus systems are that the controls are very similar to the Nimbus design. Some modifications to improve the pointing accuracy to about 7/10 of a degree about all axes. And we've added here an attitude sensor to determine, to measure the local vertical to an accuracy better than the control system will control, to a 1/10 of a degree, and this is used for image location purposes. The orbit adjust system is a new addition to the spacecraft. However, it is patterned after an orbit adjust system that has space experience. The wideband system for the communications links for the payload is a new design for ERTS because of the bandwidth of the sensors. The telemetry tracking and command system is a composite of existing systems and systems used in the manned space flight program. We have a requirement on ERTS, the telemetry tracking and command area, to be compatible with both the manned space flight network stations and the STATAN stations. Therefore, we have a unified S-band system operating with the MISFEN stations and a VHF system operating with the STATAN stations. Power, primarily patterned after the Nimbus design, with the exception of increasing the payload regulated bus capability to take into account the payload power demands, and the structure and thermal control system essentially the same. Summarizing then, the spacecraft area, we have the controls, the power, the structure, and the thermal control system, which are essentially applications of existing designs and, in fact, even existing hardware. In the telemetry tracking and command and the orbit adjust system, we're modifying some designs to meet this particular application. In the wideband area, this is a new application, and, of course, the payload is new. I will briefly look at the operations control center design, which is shown here. Again, the functions, mission planning, scheduling, commanding of the spacecraft, the reduction of the telemetry housekeeping data. These functions are performed primarily by the computer complex shown, its peripherals and software. Access and control of the computer is through the keyboards shown here, the five consoles, each with cathode ray tube displays. The mode of operation of the control center is governed almost exclusively by the time profile of contacts between the spacecraft and the ground stations. During a contact, or during a pass, as we would call it, the computer is operating in a real-time mode. That is, telemetry is received, relayed directly through the NASCOM facilities to the COM processor. It's decommutated, made available to the computer for output on any of the peripheral devices, or can be called up by the CRTs for display. Commanding at the initiation of the consoles sends commands directly through the NASCOM links, relayed by the remote station directly to the spacecraft, operating in essentially a real-time mode. Now, in between passes, we operate in an offline mode, and this is primarily to process the narrowband telemetry that was stored during an orbit, and also to plan for the next series of contacts. Real-time payload data can also be evaluated for those contacts with the NTTF station at Goddard. That station is very close to the location of the operations control center and will be connected by a hard line so that we have the capability here of looking at the video data as it's received. Now, the operations control center provides several important inputs to the data processing facility. The first of these is the narrowband telemetry tapes. This has all the spacecraft housekeeping data, and in particular, it includes the spacecraft attitude information and the timing information on when the payload was operated. The second type of data that it supplies is the data collection system tapes. Data collection data is transmitted to the remote ground sites whenever the spacecraft is in mutual view of one of these ground platforms and the ground site. It's recorded there. Immediately post-pass, it's played back to the operations control center. It's decoded and then made available to the data processing facility. The final type of data that the OCC provides is the wideband video tapes for those passes at NTTF. The other tapes are nailed directly from Alaska or from the Corpus Christi station. I will take a look at the third element. This is a functional diagram of the NASA Data Processing Facility. This facility, primary job is the conversion of the videotapes to film images, the reproduction of those film images, in some cases making computer-compatible digital data tapes, providing certain user services, and, as I mentioned, the distribution of the data to the users. There are three types of processing that is done in the Operations Control Center. All data is bulk processed. It's received as video, and it's converted to a 70-millimeter film by an electron beam on film recorder. As this conversion is done, it's also annotated, a grayscale is added, and the coarse gridding or location is performed. There is some radiometric and geometric correction done in this conversion process as well. And the 70-millimeter images are enlarged in the photoprocessing area, and composites made from various spectral bands in order to make color composites and the like. Precision and special processing are done only on a small fraction of the data. Estimates are about 5% of the data will receive one of these types of processing. In precision processing, we're attempting to take the input images, which in this system are the 70-millimeter outputs from bulk processing, and lay these out with very good geometric accuracy in a map grid or a reference coordinate system as accurately as we can, and apply all of the radiometric calibrations that we know how to make in this process. We'll talk a little bit more about how this operates later. Special processing is primarily an editing routine. It formats the data on computer-compatible digital tapes. It starts with some high-density tapes and puts them in computer-compatible form. The last function that the data processing facility does is the general storage and retrieval type of activity. Here the data is archived. A record of the data that is accumulated is filled up in catalogs so that users can see what data has been collected over the most recent period of time. There's a browse file capability maintained here so that users can come in and take a look at a particular piece of imagery. And, of course, all the distribution services. One final comment on this slide is the functions of the NDPF computer system. As I indicated, it provides the annotation data during the conversion of the video to films. The location data here is computed from the spacecraft attitude data, the time that the payload is operated, and from the ephemeris data. It's the production control center for this whole operation. It distributes the work orders for the various jobs to be performed. The final function of the computer is the processing of the data collection system data for the users. Now, thus far, we've talked about the overall ERT system. At this point, I'd like to delve into just a few of the specific ERT's requirements and the approaches that were taken to meet these requirements. These are certainly not an exclusive list of the requirements, but I've taken three areas. One will relate to the ground coverage requirement. Another will relate to the requirements of the S-band communication link for the payload data. And the final one will be on the location requirements for the precision process data. So I've taken three scattered examples of ERT's requirements and what we will do in the system to implement these. This slide indicates the preferred type of coverage or the required type of coverage that we would like to achieve. On, let's say, the first orbit of a particular day, which would be shown here by this black swath, this would be a 100 nautical mile wide swath that's viewed by the sensors, would appear at any arbitrary location. The following orbit would be shifted about 1,500 miles to the west. There are 14 orbits a day, and on the 15th orbit or the first orbit of the next day, we like that swath laid down adjacent to the corresponding orbit of the previous day and have it overlapped by approximately 10 nautical miles at the equator. Likewise, the second orbit of the second day, we'd like to overlay just slightly with the second orbit of the first day. Now, this sequential coverage will continue until in 18 days we have filled in the area between the two initial orbits, and this, of course, will occur all the way around the globe. This whole process we've termed a coverage cycle, and it takes 251 orbits. Now, there's a second and important requirement here, and that is that from one coverage cycle to the next coverage cycle, that is one 18-day period to the next 18-day period, we'd like each of these 251 orbits from one coverage cycle to overlay the next 251 orbits within plus or minus 10 nautical miles. So as we start the coverage cycle and continue it through when we start the next 18-day coverage cycle, we'd like to fly down these same traces within 10 nautical miles and continue to do this for the duration of the mission. This provides ease in the comparison of data collected over a given area from one coverage cycle to the next. Orbit insertion accuracy of the Delta launch vehicle is clearly not sufficient to achieve the required orbital parameters to get this kind of coverage. The specific parameters and numbers are given in the text that we must achieve, so that we must provide an orbit adjust capability to remove these launch vehicle injection errors and establish the proper orbital parameters, primarily orbital period. In addition to that, there are perturbations to the orbit, so that after the orbit is established, these perturbations, and the principal one is drag, even at 500 miles, the drag is sufficient to perturb the orbit sufficient, so these coverage requirements will not be maintained over the life of mission. Therefore, we have to periodically trim the orbit. So the system implementation in this area is to provide the orbit adjust capability on the spacecraft to remove the initial injection errors and to then maintain the orbit. And as I indicated, this is done with a monopropellant hydrazine system based on an existing design. We also need the capability to accurately track and determine the orbital parameters. For this, we use the unified S-band range rate system in conjunction with the manned spaceflight network and the orbital computation capability that exists at Goddard. So this particular requirement now then is satisfied by primarily through existing capabilities and a orbit adjust system, which is a modification of an existing design. The next area that I was going to talk about are the two wideband S-band payload links from the spacecraft to the ground. The requirements in this area are to provide two simultaneous downlinks. And these downlinks must be compatible with either the return beam Vidicon data or the multispectral scanner data. Now, the Vidicon has a data output that's 3.5 megahertz video. The multispectral scanner is 15 megabit per second PCM data. At the same time, we must establish links that produce minimum signal degradation on these signals. For the camera system, we've said less than 1 dB, and for the scanner system, a bit error rate of 10 to the minus fifth or better. We have been allocated two 20 megahertz RF bands in order to establish these links at S-band. One is at 2229.5 megahertz, the other 2265.5 megahertz. So we have two 20 megahertz bands separated by about 15 megahertz. The system must also operate with either of the types of ground stations. It must operate into the 30-foot manned space flight network receiving dishes or the 85-foot stateend dishes, and must operate for elevation angles down to 5 degrees above the horizon. This next slide will show the overall configuration of the wideband link. There are six possible inputs to the system, three from each of the sensors, either real-time data or data that is stored on either one of two of the airborne videotape recorders. The video switching matrix selects two of these six signals, does appropriate filtering and conditioning, and provides this data to the frequency modulators. Video FM and PCM FSK are used for the cameras and the scanner, respectively, so the same type of modulator design can be used in each case. The only difference is they're operating at a different frequency. Normally, the modulators are connected directly to the power amplifiers. The hybrid summing and switching network provides the capability in the event of a failure of one of the amplifiers to sum the two modulator outputs and provide this to the remaining power amplifier for simultaneous transmission of both types of data, however, in a degraded mode. The power amplifiers are traveling wave tube type. Power level is commandable, 10 or 20 watts. For most modes of operation, 10 watts is satisfactory. For the case of the RBV camera system operating into the smaller dishes at the low elevation angles, we do need 20 watts to maintain the caliber of the signal. The antennas are shape beam antennas with a higher gain at the horizon than at the sub-satellite point in order to optimize the overall link performance. Now, in this particular subsystem, we don't have the luxury of having the space-proven hardware available to plug in each of these areas. However, the design is clearly state-of-the-art, and many designs exist in breadboard stages which come close to meeting, or in some cases meet, the particular ERTS requirements. Now, the final area that I want to talk about is the image location requirements. For bulk process data, that's all the data, we have a requirement to locate the data within 2 nautical miles. And to do this, we envision an open-loop system which will take the attitude, the ephemeris, and the timing information and compute the viewed ground area and locate and the coordinates of that area. For precision process data, we'd like to locate the data as accurately as possible. In this case, we have a goal, and I'll distinguish a goal from a requirement here, of locating to within 1 picture element, or a few hundred feet. Basically, what we want to do here is to fit the image to a specific coordinate system or map reference system. The approach that we've used is to use what we call ground control points, and that's shown on this slide. Ground control points are simply any point that's recognizable in the image whose location is known or can be precisely determined. Now, in this particular figure, we've shown 3 ground control points being imaged by a camera system. The camera system, assuming that it has constant geometry, will image these ground control points in a unique location, and there is only one position and orientation of the camera for which these ground control points will appear in their specific location. Now, in ERTS, we measure the location of where the ground control points actually occur, compare this to where they should occur, and then make the appropriate transformation to fit them to their actual locations. In fact, we compute an error matrix across the whole image. We don't just manipulate the control points, but manipulate the whole image. In the example I've shown here, we have shown 3 ground control points. That's a sufficient condition. We can use more to overdetermine and improve the overall accuracy. Now, in the proposed system, we have gone to an automatic or semi-automatic technique because of the quantities of data involved. We are collecting in the order of 10,000 images per week. That's an individual spectral band. And even though only about 5% of this is processed by the precision processing equipment, it's still a relatively large quantity of data. The scheme used is shown here on this slide. Basically, we have 2 XY translatable stages, one here and one here, under control of the computer. The input image is mounted to the top stage. A series of reference ground control points are mounted to the bottom stage. Now, these ground control points are actually very small image chips of a ground control point whose location has been determined. There are many, many of these chips mounted on a given plate. So the operation of the system then is that the computer directs the ground control point stage to go to the first ground control point, and the ground control point scanner then views that specific point. The input image is located to approximately the first ground control point. Recall, we know about 2 nautical miles where that should occur, and the image scanner is then looking in the vicinity of that point. We then turn on the image correlator. That then servos the image stage to the precise location of the ground control point. At this point, we then record the specific XY coordinates of the location of that point in the image, and then the process repeats itself. We continue to go through this until all the ground control points within the input image are determined, and then compute the necessary transformation. After the transformation is computed, the process of writing the corrected image is done by an additional CRT not shown on this diagram, but the image scanner scans a segment, corrections are applied to that particular segment, and then this is written on a segment of the 9.5-inch output format. Now, the designs of this equipment are based largely on automatic stereo plotting equipment that has been developed in order to take a stereo pair of aerial photographs and make an orthophoto from it. Experiments on this type of stereo plotting equipment indicate that, in fact, the accuracies approaching a 1 picture element, RMS over the image, are in fact achievable. I've tried to give you a summary of the overall ERTS system, and we've looked specifically at the spacecraft, the Operations Control Center, and the NASA Data Processing Facility to give you a system overview. And we've delved into a few of the specific requirements, looked at the systems that are used to implement these requirements. These examples were taken from diverse areas of the program so that you get an appreciation for the various technologies involved. I hope the underlying philosophy or design philosophy has come through here. We have tried in every case to apply existing designs, techniques, and in many, many cases, hardware to satisfy the particular requirements. And this might seem like an unduly conservative approach. However, the launch of ERTS-A is scheduled for the spring of 72. This is a total of 20 months from program go-ahead to the launch of the first spacecraft. And we feel that by this application of existing techniques, designs, and so forth, we maximize the ability to meet this particular schedule. Thank you.
A question. What is the application of the three TV cameras on the spacecraft?
The three cameras on the spacecraft are three individual cameras. Each has its own spectral filter, so each is sensing in a specific spectral band.
Are those overlapping with your infrared image scanning system?
Yes, the spectral bands are overlapping. As I indicated, because of the importance of this particular requirement or mission objective of collecting spectral data, there are two types of sensors that sense, and the spectral bands do overlap. So they're sensing, to a certain extent, in the same spectral region.
What resolution do you have on your infrared spectrum scanner?
The line scanner has an instantaneous view of about instantaneous field of view of about 230 feet on the ground. Now, that's in the visible and near IR channels. On ERTS-B, there will be a fifth channel in the, I think it's 10 to 12 or 12 to 14 micron region, and that will have a instantaneous field of view three times as large as the other bands, as the visible bands.
And the next question is, what spectrum in your infrared region are you monitoring with your infrared scanner? Up to what resolution, milliradians?
The spectral range of the fifth band, I think, is 10 to 12 microns.